Good afternoon, everyone. I am very short, so I'm going to try to stand a little bit so that y'all can see me. And I'm also getting over a cold, so please bear with me. But I'm excited to be here today to talk to you about the Smoke-Free New Orleans Ordinance, or as we like to call it, Smoke-Free NOLA. The passage of this ordinance in January and its implementation in April was tremendous for our state. New Orleans is a major population center and economic driver in our state, and it's one of those things that, you know, it's very difficult to pass something at the state level, and once you can get a big city like New Orleans to go, then you can get a little bit more traction statewide. But I also like to mention that Alexandria actually had a comprehensive ordinance like the Smoke-Free NOLA ordinance as early as, I believe it was 2012. But it's a much smaller place, North Louisiana, so it didn't have quite the splash. So we're excited to have, you know, one of the drivers to go. So since 2007, Louisiana has been protected by the Smoke-Free Air Act, and that covered most workplaces, but notably it excluded bars, casinos, and outdoor construction sites. And this is what Smoke-Free NOLA closed the gap in. And it also included electronic nicotine delivery devices, because, you know, back in 2007, that really wasn't on our radar yet. Of course, you've all seen this. I have to say it, no relationship. Just to give you a little bit of an overview, my presentation is going to focus on the objective data that we've collected over the 5 to 6 month period since the ordinance was implemented on April 22nd, 2015. We'll cover health impacts as described by the air quality study, as well as data related to smoking cessation. And we'll touch on compliance and economic data by looking at the city's 311 complaint line, as well as casino gaming revenue. All right, so in partnership with the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, TFL conducted a study of 9 bars and 1 casino, and the air quality measurements were taken multiple times in each venue, and we used the gold standard, which is particulate matter, PM2.5, was used in the collection. And so these are our stunning results, expected results, but nonetheless important to share. We found that before implementation of Smoke-Free NOLA, air quality in the bars in the one casino that was included was considered hazardous to human health according to the EPA Air Quality Index. This is seen in the leftmost column and in maroon. After implementation, the air quality improved significantly, as indicated by a 96% decline, and is comparable to outdoor air and considered good by the EPA. So next we'll talk a bit about compliance. So the City of New Orleans has a service called 311. It's available both online and via telephone, and it's a mechanism to allow residents to report complaints, you know, potholes, crime, anything, to reach their city council persons, as well as get information related to city services. So the Smoke-Free NOLA ordinance mandated the city's Department of Health that they would be in charge of this compliance piece, and so they married it with 311. So it included a mechanism for people to make complaints about ordinance violations to the 311 line. So the way it worked is that if a bar, casino, or other business received 2 or more complaints via 311, a health officer was then sent out to the location to investigate the claims and determine if a fine should be imposed. So in the 6 months since the ordinance passed, there are only 34 complaints registered via 311. 7 of these complaints involve one particular bar. So when we take that into account, there really were 28 businesses that we received complaints about. And this is pretty impressive when you consider that New Orleans has over 500 bars. So 28 complaints, not too bad. And as I mentioned, there were 4 site visits and no fines were issued. So now I'll talk about casino data. So New Orleans is home to Harrah's of New Orleans Casino. It's the only land-based casino in the state, and it's the only casino, the major casino in the city. There's also a racetrack, but they really didn't play an important role in our ordinance in terms of opposition or anything of that matter. So we focus mostly on what's happening with Harrah's, because they were very vocal and definitely brought a lot of money in opposition to our efforts. So Harrah's pays taxes directly to both the city of New Orleans and the state of Louisiana. So as you can imagine, that broadens the base of people who really care what's happening with their business. And it means that, you know, that made them a very formidable opponent. And it was imperative for us to monitor their revenue and conduct our own analysis so that we could be able to support or refute their claims as necessary, because, you know, not only is this a policy issue or, you know, just straight scientific issue, it also involves media and perception and so many other things. I mean, y'all know from my intro that my background is very different from this. So I'm used to just, you know, publishing my research, giving some talks, maybe there'll be some changes in clinical care, you know, the hospital do things differently. But this was a very different animal in the learning experience to see, you know, we said this data, and then they said, that's correct. And so you have to do a lot of explaining, and it's about perception. And so that's why it's important to also, you know, be at the forefront of that. So to the casino data. So this chart talks about previous month's gross gaming revenue. So we're looking at specifically the change from month to month. Harrah's is indicated in purple. Excuse me. And all of the other casinos in the state are lumped together and represented in orange. So I think this distorts it a little bit because they're averaged out over all the casinos, but it makes a nice broad comparison for us. And again, just want to point out that Harrah's is the only casino in New Orleans. Not the only gaming facility, but it's the only casino. So because smoke-free NOLA was implemented in late April, we wouldn't expect to see any changes in revenue that might be linked to the ordinance until May of 2015. So you can see that there's this gray vertical line and a little box saying smoke-free NOLA, April 22nd. So to the right of that is everything since. And left everything before. So in the months since the ordinance passed, Harrah's performed better than other casinos in the state in July and September, and they had an amazing month in July. Their gross gaming revenue was up 73.5% compared to the month before. But when we look at the 5 months before the ordinance was into effect, they only outperformed other casinos once, and that was in March. So they were positive territory in December, but they outperformed the other casino specifically in March. And it's not very clear from these slides, but I just would like to also make a point that casino revenue is very volatile. It changes by season, and they have wild swings of profitability, wild losses. So I actually had tracked their revenues since they opened, for 10 years, since they opened after Hurricane Katrina. And the trend is down, very clearly down, even before the ordinance. But they're just like wild swings. So it's very difficult to glean much information from such a short period of, you know, 5 months out. So this next slide is now looking at the revenues compared to the previous year. So let's take, for example, the first date on this chart is December 2014. So that is looking at 2014 gross gaming revenue compared to December 2013. So for all these, it's just the year, same month, but the year prior. And we see that in the 5 months leading up to the ordinance, which is effectively December 2014 through April 2015, Harrah's had a decrease in gross gaming revenue compared to the same period in the previous year, which is December 2013 to April 2014. But in the 5 months since the ordinance was implemented, Harrah's outperformed their prior year's gross gaming revenue in the months of July and September. So just kind of showing again, you know, the data's volatile. They've had had a few more wins in the months since, but it's just too early to draw any conclusions, but that's what we've seen so far. So in the next slide, we'll talk about cessation data. So Louisiana Campaign for Tobacco-Free Living tracks two types of cessation data: information that we receive from the state's quit line and then the Smoking Cessation Trust. So I don't know if you all have heard about our Smoking Cessation Trust, but it's unique to Louisiana. It was formed in 2011 as a result of a class action lawsuit, and the ruling provided that certain tobacco companies fund a 10-year smoking cessation program in our state. The trust is court established, court supervised, and authorized to provide cessation services to residents of Louisiana who began smoking prior to September 1st, 1988. So this is really a very limited group of people, but very helpful nonetheless. So here we'll examine registered quitline callers from the New Orleans area. And on this table, you see that it says Orleans Parish registered callers. So I'd like to point out that Orleans Parish and New Orleans are coterminous. So New Orleans is the only city that is in that parish. And if you don't know, parish is similar to county. And within the county, New Orleans is the only municipality. So we're talking about the same place. So 2014 call volume is indicated in yellow, and 2015 is in teal. Overall, there was a higher call volume in 2015, but there are a few important points to make. So in the months of July and August, in both 2014 and 15, there were ads from the CDC's TIPS campaigns running. So both years had TIPS campaigns, but we still saw a 30% higher call volume in 2015. So that made some of the comparisons over this time a little bit tricky, because there were two phases that ran, I think, in 2014 and one in 15. But I think it's just really nice to point out that they were both running in July and August, and we still see overall more calls in 2015. Can't say for certain that it's related to the ordinance, but it could be, but can't say for certain. All right. And next, we're looking at the number of judge-approved members that were added to the Smoking Cessation Trust. And we see the same pattern as in the previous slide. There are more trust approvals in 2015. An interesting point to note here is that since the ordinance passed, depending on the month, 47% to 64% of registered quitline callers then went on to become approved members of the Smoking Cessation Trust. So I'll start wrapping up my presentation here, start moving into some conclusions. So Louisiana Campaign for Tobacco-Free Living has tracked three important metrics: health, compliance, and casino revenue. In terms of health, we've seen a 96% decline in air particulate matter in our bars and casino, effectively going from a rating of hazardous to human health to good, which is comparable to outdoor air. The city of New Orleans continues to receive complaints via 311. Excuse me. And to date, there have been relatively few calls and no fines issued. As I mentioned, the casino business is both seasonal and volatile. More time and revenue data is needed to determine whether or not the ordinance had any impact on their business profitability at this time. So that, I think that's really the take-home message with the casino, that it's just not enough data, it's too early, so we will continue to track that. And next steps. So over the next 6 months, we're going to continue to track casino data in New Orleans and throughout the state. Monitor quitline volume and trust approval. In early October, TFL and partners administered a citywide opinion poll about the ordinance. So we got that data just before I got here. So looking forward to doing a complete analysis of those results. And we're also working on getting bar revenue from the city so that we can do similar, you know, analysis, track them just as we track the casinos. And the city is going to continue to monitor 311 complaints. And that concludes my presentation. So thank you so much for your attention. And I'll leave this up in a few minutes in case you guys want my contact information, but I'm happy to chat afterwards.
So we have a few minutes now for, sorry about that. We have a few minutes now for questions. Does anybody have any questions for our speakers? Yes, ma'am.
I don't have it off of the top of my head, but we are not talking about large cities here. Boulder is probably, I think Boulder, Colorado is probably the biggest one. Boise, Idaho has functionally had, just based on the way that they have these big setbacks. And if you haven't been to downtown Boise lately, go to downtown Boise, it's awesome. They're functionally tobacco, tobacco free or smoke free downtown area. But so we're talking about medium to large size cities. Yeah, I think that, I really think they are, because typically resources are scaled as well. So some of the, the opinion polling and the key informant interviews and the focus groups are, probably pretty stable in terms of the resource. What would be bigger are the observational studies. I still am a big proponent of those observational studies, not only to demonstrate a problem, but also in places where they have policies in place. So if you go back and look later, I think it could provide you with a really nice baseline. So it would obviously take more resources, but I think it's doable. I think one of the trickier issues is defining downtown areas and getting into some of those areas where, what is downtown, and that can be in larger jurisdictions, that I think would be a little bit trickier.
Yes,
I'm interested in smoke-free housing. Is there any incentives to talk to landlords about how they're going to reduce insurance costs for companies? Do we have any studies or metrics to say you smoke-free housing, you'll save X number of dollars? So even getting insurance companies, homeowners, insurance companies to try to promote this, as like they do for life insurance, say, are you a tobacco user or not, it's X number of dollars, if they can see it in black and white, smoke-free housing or not, they're more likely to choose that.
We have some of that data. It varies so much from company to company, though. We work with about 5 companies in Maine who will tell us that information, but again, it depends on who the underwriter is. It has to be a comprehensive fire safe policy. It's not just passing a smoke-free policy, you also put that in your sprinkler system, you have to have this and that. Unfortunately, it's hard to tease out just the smoke-free housing piece of it, but what we tell every landlord and we publish them on our website and on our fact sheets are just, until you ask, you don't know. So we've heard of people saving 5 to 10% on property casualty insurance when they pass the smoke-free policy, but we can't tell you your insurer is going to do that, but you can try to leave your insurer if they don't. So those are the types of things that we talk to them about.
It just seems that if it's not in the literature already, it's a great thing to ask for all of us.
Yeah.
Not just Maine, but wherever.
No, I think this what I'm saying is what you see right now in the literature. It will be interesting to do a more, a study or do a little research that is a little more consistent over maybe 15 or 20 companies of the larger companies. That may push other companies to start looking at this a little bit more.
Yes, you, sir.
Yeah, Yeah, a question for you, Tina. You think any success working with condo boards on smoke-free housing? It's one of the issues that we've run into is that we're legally complicated. Mm-hmm. I mean, 50% approval to change rules, we need 2/3 approval to change a charter. A charter needs to be drafted by an attorney to follow the state. So,
they're certainly much more complicated. They're usually more time intensive. We have worked certainly with condo associations across the state to a varying degree of success. Because there are so many more variables with condos, it takes more time, it takes more energy, it takes usually it's a longer process than working with a private landlord. But it's certainly not impossible. We produce a condo specific fact sheet that we are able to provide. What I think is important in those situations, which again is time intensive, but we go and speak to the condo association board. We're there to answer questions, certainly not legal questions, but to answer general questions about smoke-free housing. Because the issue itself, of course, is no different in a condo than it is in any other multi-unit housing. But like you said, you have the other factors that people have to agree. Sometimes we have to do, for lack of a better word, lobbying behind the scenes to those specific board members to make sure that they understand what the issue is like. But it can be. We've had condo association. We've worked over 3 years to get a policy passed. But then, then 1,000 people are impacted, so.
Yes, sir.
So, Tina, given the broad coverage you already have in Maine, all your public housing is covered and not that a lot of private housing, are there any initiatives afoot, either at the city or county level, to enact legislation that would require all the housing to be smoke-free?
No.
And are you not
we don't do that in Maine.
No, just because the local government just wouldn't want it to happen?
It's just not the culture of our state. I know there's other states that prefer to do it like that, but for us, knowing the kind of political temperament, it's just not the way people like to do things. So,
man in the black. No, you. Yes, you. Yeah, I'm sorry, female. I'm sorry. So sorry. I meant female.
I know it's getting late.
I know. I'm so sorry.
Okay. My question is directed to Jill. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the two towns that you shared your story, that downtown smoke-free movement. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, did those cities, I'm thinking I understand maybe back in 2001, but not so much the one that did it in 2009. Mm-hmm. What was the intent that drove them just to focus on downtown as opposed to the entire city?
Thank you for your question, and I think I heard most of it. There was a little racket behind me. What those cities had passed in 1 of the cities passed a comprehensive smoke-free workplace law in 2001 that covered all the bars, the restaurants, any indoor work area, and with a, I believe, a 10-foot setback in Eugene City, the one city. The other city had a comprehensive smoke-free workplace law due to being covered by a statewide smoke-free workplace law. So they already had completely tobacco or smoke-free workplaces, and these ordinances would have dealt mostly with the outdoor area. Yes.
Observations at the end that this is plateau, that you've seen less progress from 2010 to 2015, and I think you probably said similar things in the UK. And there's a new report been published called Smoking Still Kills, which during the last year are politicians, etc. I wonder if you had any thoughts about what you think could kickstart another wave of interest
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and one that's certainly discussed at the end. I think what we're looking at, and the heart of your question is, we're stuck in knowing what works, but not having the will to make it happen. And right now, obviously, there's distracting conversations when it comes to the other products that are being introduced that kind of moves us away from what we're really focused on, which is getting people to quit smoking, and that's responsible for the lion's share. I think that what we find is when we put out new data, new information, we still are getting media coverage for it. Where we're not getting really the traction that we need is the decision makers going ahead and making those changes. And where we see, and what I point to, like the biggest problem is in specific states, specific areas of the country, where it's leaving a lot of people uncovered. And so I think, when we have these conversations, a lot of people, and it's very opinion personally, and it's not the CDC's view, it's my view, it's, I think when we're looking at a geographic disparity and a disparity of people who don't look like actually the people in this room right now, for the most part. Most people I talk to think smoking epidemic is over. No one they know smokes. There's no one in City A that smokes anymore. And that's what people's reality is. But the reality for other people is so far from that. And so we're trying to look at things, people with mental health conditions, certainly people with lower socioeconomic, and kind of doing that. And I'm hoping that sort of social justice perspective will have great attraction. But I watch TV like everybody here and I read the headlines. And I think in our country right now, it's just the political reality is not such that it doesn't mirror really 1999 or 2006 for that matter. So really not a great answer. And I recognize that. But having the solution, but without having the will to do it, is really problematic. And I think that's why, it's so important that that slide at the end, where it's basically only 72%. And it's just different in the UK here, too, and the whole perspective, right? We're facing something similar, but the discourse here is the same. And we're seeing a lot of movement, and it's certainly not what we're talking about now, but states are, you see a lot of people galvanizing around moving the purchase age to 21, and, that actually has gotten a lot of traction and a lot of people excited and getting more involved in the other things. NOLA has really been helpful. We actually saw some great movement and interest in some of the southern localities, because if NOLA goes, then everyone else can do it too. And I think this is kind of like what we're building on. But right now, if there's anything that people are kind of grasping on.
Any other questions? Thank you all for coming. I know this was a hard session at the end and during lunch, so we really appreciate your attendance and your interest. Thank you.